supposed to be about New Orleans, and I don't know if this is on the schedule on the board. I think it is. It says something about City of a Million Dreams, and I can explain that by playing something for you on the clarinet, and that's the name of this song is City of a Million Dreams. It was written by, or I say written, see, this guy couldn't read music. It was composed by Raymond Burke, who is a New Orleans clarinetist whom I got to know. And this is a clarinet.
At least I hope so. We'll see.
Oh, yeah, and not the brain. No. That's, as I said, it's called City of a Million Dreams, which it kind of is to a lot of people. And that is actually something that Raymond improvised on the spot when he was recording or rehearsing or something with a bunch of guys. And he used to play like that. They were playing bass and street blues and had the same chord changes, at least most of that, as this other more popular number called Bass and Street Blues, and you would come up with stuff like that. But that one they decided to record before he forgot it, so it became something that a lot of people play nowadays. I'm one of those people. And Raymond was one of the guys, I need to tell you a little bit about my experience with New Orleans because it was a big life changer for me. He was one of the people I met when I first went there, and this was in 1962, when, of course, I was 5 years old, right? Anyway, no, I wasn't, but I was a teenager, just barely. I was almost 19, and I'd been hoping to be some kind of a jazz musician and been playing the piano and took the clarinet up when I was in high school to be in the band and all that. And I liked all kinds of different things, didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but when I got to New Orleans, It just hit me. And this collision between cultures is a big part of this experience that we have with jazz and certainly with African-American music. I'm a Lutheran like you guys, and it was a real collision because I come from Minnesota where, without going into any detail, I go to New Orleans, and this is a place where they have all these costumes and parades and wonderful food and everybody's laughing all the time and they have parties and they have music all over the place and it's just in the weather. I mean, it was hot, it was, oh man. And I was about ready for some kind of a shock like that, but that has nothing, I still haven't said anything much about the music I heard. That was a shock too. I walked into a place which had only recently opened its doors for business, and it was called Preservation Hall. And there's all these guys who were working there at the time. There was a cadre of, I don't know, something like 40 could be as many as 50 musicians who were kind of taking turns playing in there, some real favorites and others who weren't there as often. But they were people who had been mostly born about the turn of the 20th century, so they were in their 60s probably. I thought they were ancient, and couldn't believe they could play at all, let alone something this great. I mean, really, aren't you dumb when you're a kid? Anyway, and some of them were considerably older. There was one guy who was born in the late 1880s. He was a bass player. And if you've ever seen, you know, big upright bass, if you've ever seen a New Orleans bass player who plays that old style, that's a lot of work. You know, he's really pulling those strings. He was fantastic. I was just knocked out by this, and it only took me about one night of listening to these guys to be pretty much converted. I'd never seen anything like it. And what the big thing about New Orleans and the music, after thinking about it for years, is I think it was really kind of real in a way that I wasn't used to. Because jazz, even by my time so long ago, over 40 years ago, a lot of it had become concert music. And of course, that's what I'm doing for a kind of a racket, trying to make a living playing concerts myself right now. But in fact, these guys were culturally didn't quite get it that this would be concert music. And at this point, when I heard them, they hadn't been out playing concerts yet under the Preservation Hall banner anyway. But their perception of their music was different. They thought of it as a connection to the community, and it was all serving a function all the time. So even Preservation Hall was a little bit artificial to them, I suppose, because they'd come in and sit down in chairs and play, and people would sit on benches, you know, not in quite as good a shape as these pews or whatever you want to call these seats, but and stare at them while they played. And they'd look at each other and say, boy, amazing for those geezers that they can play like this. And, you know, it was kind of like they were a spectacle all of a sudden, and I think it may actually have started to occur to them that something was different even at that early point. They started touring with the band, and one trumpet player, Thomas Valentine, who I got his name as Kid Thomas, he used to talk about this. He'd say, I don't like all those fish eyes out there. He said, he said, you know, they're just staring at me. What am I supposed to do? He was not used to it. His life in music had been playing for dancing or for any kind of occasion. All the musicians that had business cards, it always said music for all occasions. It didn't say Dixieland. It didn't say jazz. Mostly just said music for all occasions, telephone number. And that's what they did. I saw them play for all kinds of functions. Of course, the famous thing is the parade in the dance hall. But they did other stuff. It was always something that the connection between them and the people for whom they were playing was a big part of it. And I talked with others, notably a trombonist named Jim Robinson, who said exactly that. He said, I can play better when I'm playing for the people, when I see they're dancing and they're having a good time and they're getting with the music, that makes me play all the better. He said, I can play all night. That's just no problem as long as I think the people are with me. So that connection was something that, you know, there is a connection, needless to say, in the concert hall, but it's different. And I had never seen anything like this. These guys were actually, they had a real pride in their music, but they thought of it as a service or a craft. They wouldn't think of themselves in lofty artistic terms, probably. And, you know, even the great famous Louis Armstrong, who's from down there, really thought of himself as, he never would say that, oh, I'm a great, you know, this is artistic, whatever he was doing. No matter how artistic it really was, he thought of himself as an entertainer. And that was a function. And that's the way he looked at it. And that's what he always tried to do. So, but to me, what they were playing was what really got me, because I never heard anything quite like it. And I can't really put it across very well to you just talking about it, nor can I duplicate it on the piano. But if you've been at any of these other sessions, you know that I'm making a big deal out of the fact that the rhythm is the heart of it, and it certainly is that. But another big part of it is the multiple rhythms. You've got the basic rhythm, and then you've got all these things going on over the top of it simultaneously. And I have a recording, but I think I'll play something first. And I was talking about Jelly Roll Morton, or at least I played something by him. Here's one other piece by him, which I was supposed to play at the blues concert, but it doesn't really matter. It's all the same. And this is called New Orleans Joys. It's the first piece that this New Orleans-born musician ever recorded as a piano solo. And by the time he recorded this, 1923, he was in his early 30s. And then he starts making solo piano recordings. He had a great recording career, which we'll talk about a little in another session. But this first solo is interesting because it's really a blues, but it has a lot of different strains. It's sort of like a rag. It's like a blues. And it also has the Latin American content that is always there in any kind of American music, like stuff we're talking about. It's there somewhere, even if it's not obvious. So this is called New Orleans Joys from a recording, though I don't copy the records exactly, of 1923. So that has a bunch of the stuff in it. What I'm going to play next is a street band. It was a marching band called the Eureka Brass Band from New Orleans. Long gone now. This is recorded in 1962, actually the same time that I was in New Orleans. This big label, Atlantic, came down there to record a whole series of LPs, including the one that this track is on, by the Eureka Brass Band, and it's as close as you could have heard probably at that point to what the bands sounded like before any of them were ever recorded. There's some differences, but it's basically the same stuff. But what I want you to listen to in this is the layering, because you've got all these voices. There are three trumpets in here, the clarinet, there's a tenor sax, two trombones, and sousaphone, and a couple of drummers. and all these stacked up rhythms, what makes it so exciting. Boy, it's really something. And to hear something like this coming down the street was unbelievable. So we got to play it pretty loud there. But here it is.
Thank you.
I should mention that actually that's a performance in a recording studio, so it's probably a little tamer than the usual way that we play slightly, because they're not out in the street. And in the street, if you guys have ever been to New Orleans or seen anything like a parade down there, it's the street thing. And back in the 60s, it was all very much roots stuff. They weren't putting on a show for anybody except whoever's funeral it was or something a lot of times. But the people in the what they call the second line, which is the people who follow, they come to the funeral because they want to come back from the cemetery and dance behind the band. And it was incredible. That's the first time I'd seen this. And they're still doing this in New Orleans. You know, there's some reasons why you may not want to go to a lot of these parades unless you're with the right people these days. It's just not like it was in the 60s because they think you're just gawking at them or something. And it's just a different political thing right now. But at this point, we went to parades all the time, and at somebody's funeral, these second liners are just, and they jump up on roofs, and they jump from house to house, and they walk on their hands, and it's fantastic, and it's a spectacle, and they're celebrating life, and how does it go? Cry at the birth, rejoice at the death. It's something like that. It's really fabulous. So let's see what they cry about here with this next track. Let me talk about it for a second. We're not going to play the whole thing because I don't think you guys could take it. But it's probably not, just like with that last example, it's not exactly like the music at a funeral would have been, you know, back in 1915 or something. But it's as close as they could get, they thought, at least in 1958. And again, this was Atlantic Records coming down there to document this, and they wanted to make it really authentic, so they didn't go to a studio. They recorded it outside. But what I wish they hadn't done, and they did, was they tightly mic'd some of the instruments, which, of course, makes it sound unnatural. They should have had some other way of doing it. But at least you can hear pretty much what it sounded like. And this, I never had the experience of hearing this band. It's a young Tuxedo Brass band. And you know, why I'm playing this for you is because there's some totally unorthodox clarinet playing by John Casimir, who was the band leader and the business manager. He got him all the gigs and everything. And he played the E-flat clarinet, which about half the length of this. Very high, much higher pitched. And he was sort of keening and wailing and crying and sobbing over the top of everything all the time. And if you're not used to it, it's kind of shocking. But I mean, to me, that's what makes this so great. That the rest of the guys are okay, but this clarinet playing. And this is the kind of dirge tempo stuff they would play while they were taking the poor guy to the cemetery. And you'll recognize, if we get far enough, you may recognize a couple of these tunes. But I promise you don't have to listen to the whole thing. It's pretty long. But here it is, Young Tuxedo Brass Band, 1958. Thank you. recognize that one. All right. Well, and the first one is flee as a bird to the mountain, which is a pretty common theme that they play at all these funerals. But okay, there you get the idea. It's totally, and it sounds kind of, you know, when I first heard it sounds like that, I didn't care for it at all because I just didn't get it. But to see it in context, it's actually quite moving. It's completely natural expression of how everybody feels. That clarinet playing is actually pretty virtuosic. It's kind of hard to do, very hard to do. And he's over the top of everybody else. And, you know, this when you hear it coming down the street and echoing between all the buildings and everything, it's much different from this canned version. But I thought you guys ought to hear that. That's the raw stuff there. And it's like, the more I go back to that recording, the better I like it, actually. Okay, well, this is as much as we have time to do with the brass bands because I have to play a little more piano here. And we have time, so good. that just gives you a little taste of the culture of those brass bands. I should mention before I go on to the next thing, though, that they were also very, very formal and ceremonial about everything they did. The uniform for a brass band, though, was easy to have. Everybody could own this. They wear a white shirt, black tie, black trousers, black long tie, and a band cap, which is a billed affair with a shiny leather bill, and it's white, black leather bill, and it's got the name of the band probably up here on the top, Eureka Brass Band, or just Eureka or something. And, you know, everybody could have one of those. But then there'd be a lot more ceremony than that involved, in particular, the Grand Marshal. I wish I had a photo of this. I didn't think of it. I should have brought it. This guy named Fats Houston was the first one I saw to do this. They walk in front of that procession when they're doing one of these dirges, and the costumes are fantastic, fancy parasols. And I mean, I just can't even begin to tell you of course, it's like nothing I'd ever seen or heard in the Augustana Synod anyway. So that is a big part of it. You know, that's why it made such a tremendous impression on me. So we have to move along, but I think now those of you who are here at least heard something kind of sort of gets to the point of what I was going to say about New Orleans. A City of a Million Dreams, that's what Raymond Burke said about it. That was his tune that I played. And I guess just to refer to a couple more piano players other than Jelly Roll Morton, one of them is a guy named Tony Jackson who was older than Morton. Jelly Roll Morton born in 1890. Tony Jackson was something like nearly 10 years older, I think. And he was the only one who was proud of him, his performance. He really thought of himself as a superb musician, which made sense, but he wasn't afraid to tell you. But he also would say that Tony Jackson was the only one he ever heard whom he was afraid of. And this is another thing. We're talking about early jazz and all that, but these guys were extremely versatile, and Jackson was the paragon of that. Apparently he could sing and play anything from, like Morton said, blues to opera. And he'd hear something once and he'd have it. He could sing all these vocal styles, play all this music. And so I'll play a song, tune for you. Some of you will recognize this tune. It's Tony Jackson's song. I'll just play it just for that reason. About one chorus. Play the verse and one chorus of this and see if anybody knows it. This was a big hit for Tony Jackson back not long after the turn of the 20th century, sort of might be as late as 1920, I can't remember exactly, but I'm not going to tell you the name, you might know it. Thank you. Maybe it's a pretty baby, it's called anyway. And when I was a kid, people were singing that tune once you hear somebody say, "Everybody loves a baby," or something. So it stayed around for a long time. And some of us still recognize it. Tony Jackson. It was a tune. Here, I'll play a little example of something that Jackson never made any records, but Jelly Roll Morton said, well, he used to play sort of like this. And he played in some unsavory places. I will not talk about the specific nature of those places, but it was in New Orleans before he left town, which he did kind of early. And this was one of the pieces which Morton recorded a couple times. I guess I can tell you the name of it. It's called The Naked Dance. This is, I think, shows that Morton got some of his stuff from Tony. You can kind of hear it. Anyway, here it is. This is not the whole thing. It just goes on and on, but just to give you the idea. To save time here, it can go on at any particular length. One of the things that is interesting about New Orleans jazz that you might not think of, at least at first, is that there was a lot of great classical music, and in particular grand opera, which these musicians were exposed to while the music was being born down there. It was a place, the French Opera House, where they could hear all this music. The music was in the air, and the melodies and the tunes from some of these operas were actually so popular that a professional piano player had to know how to play them. And if you were a professional, you played requests. That's what it was about. You didn't sit back and say, no, I'm an artist. You played whatever they asked for if you could. And so they knew all of this stuff. Louis Armstrong, in particular, talked about this, and so did Jelly Roll Morton. And they used to play things from these on request. And this was I'll just give you a little version of what Morton, he called it the Miserere. It's from Il Trovatore by Giuseppe Verdi, and apparently this particular piece, which he didn't play exactly like the original at all, was asked for a lot. So he took great pride in this. And I'm getting all this from interviews that were done at the Library of Congress in 1938 with Jelly Roll Morton, who was still playing real well and not doing too well financially. But he was a good talker, and he talked about a lot of history for hours and hours, and including this. So this is the Verdi piece as Morton played out. Just give you a little sample of how he played this. He'd say this is the straight version. It isn't exactly. And then he'd say, then I transformed it into my own style, so I'll give you a kind of sample of each of those. Thank you. Well, that isn't exactly how he played it, but I don't try to copy the things if you're curious about it. But that can be heard online, I think, somewhere by Morton himself. Okay, a couple more. I talked about somebody last night without going into much detail. Named Manuel Mineta. How are we doing here? I guess we're okay. How long are these sessions? They're an hour, aren't they? More or less. Yeah. Well, we'll be kind of wrap this up with this particular thing. I think this is name is Professor Manuel Mineta. They called him Professor because he was a music teacher. And he could have left town and become a traveling musician early on, and he did go out to California, which is where a lot of New Orleans musicians went. They didn't only go north to Chicago. A lot of them moved to California, and pretty early. And Fess, as they called him, went out there with some of these guys, including great trombonist Kid Ory and his band and some others. And he just didn't want to be on the road. He also was in Chicago briefly, but so he'd rather stay home. And he lived in Algiers right across the river from the French Quarter, pretty much. And he set up a studio there and spent the rest of his life from the early 20s to 1968 just teaching people to play on every instrument which he could play. He played them all. He played everything from violin to trombone to tuba to everything else, trumpet, whatever you wanted to learn, he could play it. And I was lucky enough to see him a couple times, and there's actually some video as well of this one trick that he used to do. He billed himself as the man of 1,000 instruments, and he never left town to do much entertaining, but he was always trying to play gigs in New Orleans as well as teach. And he had all these wonderful tricks that he used to do, including play the trombone and the trumpet at the same time, which is not easy, but he could do it. I can't remember which side is which. He kind of hunch up a shoulder or something and get the trombone. He could work the slide. Yeah, he worked the slide with his right hand. Play the valves with the left. So trumpet over here and the trombone here, and he could play and harmonize things like, it was incredible. And not only slow things, but you know, stuff that was a little bit faster as well. It was part of the act. He used to play things like I'll See You in My Dreams and what was a couple of the other ones, Till We Meet Again, that kind of thing. It was really quite fantastic, not only because he harmonized, but because he wasn't exactly playing the same rhythm patterns in each either at all times. Sometimes there'd be something different going on the other side. It was really great. And another one was he could turn his back to the piano and play with the back of his fingers. It didn't sound too bad. One of his tricks that a lot of the piano players used to do, don't ask me to do it because I can't, but he played Yankee Doodle in one hand and Dixie in the other, you know, kinds of variations and cross hands, and that was crazy. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. But that's who he was. But I just wanted to tell you, and this is kind of, it's not a concert, so I'm not going to bring this to a great roaring climax or anything, but I just want to tell you something about this thing I played last night, which was a blues that he called Old New Orleans Blues. It was actually a teaching tool, this composition. He used to write things for his students to play, and this was one that he wrote for a guy who was actually preparing to write a book on it, on his teacher, Mineta, and he would record the lessons and record other people's lessons as well. His name was William Russell, a historian. He'd send students over to the studio and pay them to go take these lessons from Mineta on different instruments, and he wanted them to record. So he'd bring a great big reel-to-reel tape recorder. This was in the 50s, and they'd record these lessons. And there's some old film of Mineta doing the two trombone thing and everything too. So this was a lesson for Mr. Russell himself, who was a violinist. And he wrote this thing out as a duet for the two of them. And the melodies in this were based on things that were floating around in New Orleans when Mineta was younger. Probably most of them played by various trumpet players. And some of the things appear on recordings by people like Louis Armstrong and other New Orleans-born trumpet players from right from the 20s up into the 40s and 50s, some of these guys were still playing, including Armstrong. And I'm not going to go through each one of the melodies and tell you which trumpet player it was who played it or anything. It's too complicated, even for me. But it's just like it's folk music. There goes a bell that means something. Does it mean quit, or does it mean something? No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're just about done anyway. And as usual, I talk too much and don't play enough, but I just wanted to play this for you again. And you should keep in mind that each of these melodies is something that was part of the New Orleans culture. And the introduction that Mineta played on this is the same intro that Jelly Roll Morton used on that piece I played called New Orleans Joys. So I'll remind you of what that one sounds like. And then we'll start going into the Mineta one, you'll see. And so they asked him about this. And he remembered somebody whose nickname in New Orleans was Whinin' Boy. That was Morton. But he didn't really have much of a clear idea that Jelly Roll Morton had gone up north and become successful and that he was famous. And he said, oh, yeah, he could play a little piano. He was a black key player, and I taught him some things, you know, stuff. It was a kind of interesting perspective from the inside of some other world. And he said he had no idea that this little melody at the beginning, this introduction that he plays, was actually something that a lot of people who liked jazz would be familiar with. And he was kind of puzzled when somebody said, oh, you got that from Jelly Roll Morton's record. And of course not. It came from somewhere else, but it's just interesting. It's the same. So anyway, I'll play this piece again. And we'll probably call it a day unless you have a question or two. So it's an old New Orleans blues. First, I'll play the Morton version of this intro, and then I'll just go into the Mineta one. I can't imagine why, but if you have a question, I'm happy to entertain it back there. Yeah. Well, he did use marijuana, and he recommended it highly for whatever it could did for him, which was probably not. I don't think it was that prevalent, but back when this whole thing started with marijuana and jazz and everything, it was legal. And then this, what's the name of that law that actually outlawed it? I can't remember exactly, nor do I remember the year, but I'm sure that for Armstrong and for a lot of the others, it wasn't actually illegal, at least at first, when they started using it, so that was part of it. He would tell you, and I'm not real clear on whether he was still using it by the time I saw him live in the 50s, but I wouldn't be surprised. But he didn't have any problem with alcohol or anything like that. And where the marijuana use by Louis is most obvious on recordings is back in the 30s. And at some point there, he was actually arrested for it when he was playing out in California. And they let him out so he could go play his gigs, but they had to go back. But that didn't take long before he was out of jail. But I'm not sure he ever stopped. He probably didn't. But it doesn't seem to hurt his music. I'm not saying it's a good idea for everybody. It's not. But I don't think it adversely affected his playing because he was really serious about that and worked on it continually right up till the end of his life. Which now, he had other kinds of health regimens, which I won't even go into, but a lot of this stuff wasn't very good for him, although he recommended it highly to the world at large. And, he didn't live to be a real old man. He was, not even 71 years old when he died. So that's not that old these days, but it depends how you live to some extent. Part of it's genetics, too, of course. And then, you had a question.
Do you have a favorite key, or is
there a favorite key for this type? They're all the flat keys.
What?
Flat keys, yeah. That's but then what has happened to me is I learned to play. It's learning to play this kind of music. Everybody's playing in B flat and A flat, all this, everything flat, because it's how it went, with wind instruments, basically. But the strings are all they want to play in the sharp keys, I found myself when I got on Garrison Keillor's program. He's had a lot of string players on there. To play different kinds of music, and even if they were playing swing tunes or jazz tunes in their little string bands and stuff, I'd be playing clarinet with them. So it's even more complicated on the clarinet because you're going to have even more sharps because it's pitched in a different key. So, but that was good for me. That was really great because I've done so much playing in these flat keys. But yeah, that's where it goes. To the flats, and a lot of the pianists, if they were self-taught, really use the black keys as reference points. And it's kind of like when you're a kid, it's you can hear that, and in fact, you can hear that in some of the music by the even more sophisticated guys. Like, you just know they're coming from that. For instance, UB Blake and some ragtime things that are, and Morton too, and some of the others. It's interesting. It is, but again, it's flats. Yeah. Well, it's just there. In New Orleans, the first person to actually record things like where it's real obvious was Jelly Roll, at least in the mainstream of jazz. He talked about it. And he actually had some Haitian ancestors himself. It was a complicated racial scene in New Orleans. It's not just, African Americans and white people. It was much more complicated, and it depended. There were all kinds of strange prejudices and exclusions and things. But there was also, for a long time, a lot more freedom and easygoing atmosphere especially in the real early days, before things tightened up, unfortunately. So there was a lot of exchange too, and people were all neighbors. And the old musicians used to talk about, we used to live in the same part of town. Doesn't make any difference, you know. But there were these clubs and organizations who exclude you if your skin was a little too dark or something like that. So it was really, really complicated. But where did we start with this? Oh, the Latin American. It's like being not being in the U.S. at all to go down there to New Orleans and get to know a lot of the people. And because of the culture, it's just so flamboyant and parties, you know, the weather, of course. And as I was saying before, and so, but in Morton's case, it was something pretty close to, I think, a habanera rhythm. And some people called it the Cuban beat in New Orleans. It's island music of some kind. And, you know, it's this thing that I was doing. Real obvious, you know, because it's based on that thing exclusively. But actually, you can hear that in some early recordings by people from New Orleans, you know, after they went north, that it'll pop up all of a sudden in the middle of a tune somewhere. Somebody will suddenly be playing that for a few bars, and then they go back to where they were. And it's right under the surface. And some of the things that Morton composed actually have both the four beats to the bar and the habanera, right, sort of on top of each other. And last but not least, I should mention that on these recordings he made for the Library of Congress, these interviews with Alan Lomax, the folklorist or whatever you call him, historian, interesting person. But he actually would play these Latin American pieces, but you can hear his foot tapping. His foot's tapping four. So that's how he was feeling it. It's a kind of a combination, and the combinations are what make it interesting. Somebody over there. Oh, yeah, hi. No, that's a whole different thing because it was just a community event, you know. And the audience, or it wasn't even an audience. They were just participants, just like the musicians. And if you didn't have one, then the other one just wouldn't be the same. You know, the band actually felt better and played better. And I actually feel that myself. I'm more relaxed if somebody's out, if somebody's dancing or whatever. And I've seen those guys play for just anything, including a supermarket opening and a gas station promotion or something. it's you're doing something with everybody else. Yeah. Oh, it's deteriorated. I actually practice really hard if I have to get something ready that is new. Otherwise, what I do, though, I play all the time. Every day, probably it's not a great disciplined way of going about it, but I have this wonderful piano that I was lucky enough to get by doing some trade outs with a music store and some other stuff. And it's a Steinway B. It's a great. I just can't keep away from it if I'm at home. So I get up in the morning and usually make coffee first, but then I go sit down and start to play because it just feels so great. And I keep going back to the piano. If I'm home all day, then I'll be sitting there at least a third of the time. It's just, I like to do at least an hour when I first sit down, but then I'm going to do another hour somewhere along the way. I wouldn't call it disciplined, but I try to pull out stuff that I haven't been playing lately and clean it up so I can use it again or something. And I go through books of things that aren't too demanding, you know, some of the easier Bach things and stuff, but I don't stay on that. I like Scarlatti, and I can almost play some of those sonatas, but I'm not going to let you hear it. But I go through that kind of thing, but I also just sit there and play my stuff and try to tighten it up and change it and revamp it. And I just love to play. So it's not exactly discipline. It's just like, it's an addiction to the piano or something, especially my piano. Anyway, okay, anyone else? Yeah, for some of the things, I can't remember which one I was talking about. The Jelly Roll Morton recordings have almost all, his solo piano recordings have almost all been transcribed. It's amazing. Not much of a market. but there's a book that has just about everything in it, and it's pretty accurate. And it's just called Jelly Roll Morton Piano Works or something like that. And it's, I don't know how easy it is to find right now, but it's probably still available. And there were some transcriptions that came out a long time ago that were pretty good. But I can't remember what I was talking about, because I think you're talking about a composition, aren't you? Not a,
yeah.
And I don't remember what it was now. Oh, you know, I don't think that one's ever really been published, just recorded. Yeah, City of a Million Dreams. Yeah. Raymond Burke was a character, that clarinet player that, who wrote or composed that. And I first met him in New Orleans. My friend, who was my tour guide there, somebody you know, actually, Charlie DeVore, in 1962, took me walking down Bourbon Street. He said, "You got to meet somebody." And we got to this junk shop. And there was this guy sitting out in front on a chair, and it was Raymond Burke. He's kind of a short guy, not much of a stomach, but a little bit. And just the more I talked to him, I realized that the only thing he liked to talk about was music. Nothing else. But he had this little store where he tried to sell various things, but what he really liked in the store were all the various music devices, different kinds of record players and things, and weird instruments, something he made with a slide and a toilet plunger, and he could play that, and he had bazookas and all kinds of things, and he'd get those out and play. He'd say, "One of your high society sounds good on this." I knew him for about 20 years, and he never once did he have a topic other than, "Hey, remember this song? This is a great song." And then he'd hum it for me. He'd say, "You know that one, don't you?" Of course, I usually didn't. And it didn't matter. And it was the folkways thing as much as anything else about these guys that really got to me. I remember doing a couple of gigs with Raymond. I was on the piano. And, of course, I'm supposed to know all the harmony and the chords and if we're going to play something. But, you know, it wouldn't have made any difference in an informal setting, and it probably didn't because we were in a club. He just started playing something. And I was able to hear where he was going with the key most of the time, but it would always be almost always something. I never even heard of this. What is it? It wouldn't matter. We'd be sitting there, and I'd say, "Well, what do you want to play?" He'd say, "Oh, I don't know." And then he'd stand up and start playing. There was nothing about tempo or anything else. And we made a CD. It turned into a CD. We thought it was going to be an LP, but together, which I got a small grant from the Minnesota Arts Board in the 80s of what, no, no, what am I saying, 70s. And in fact, it was 75. Anyway, and it was him and this and a drummer and me, and we recorded it in Preservation Hall. And we practiced for this thing. We got together and just made a list of songs, and Raymond and I played them together, so we kind of had this idea. But when we got there, he played nothing that we practiced. Unbelievable. But it came out all right. It was fine. Yeah.
When you went to New Orleans when you were 19, were you playing that?
Trying to, yeah. Yeah. This guy I mentioned, who was my guide on this trip, was a cornet player who was in the band that I was in when I was trying to learn about the music. And it was called the Hall Brothers Band. And Charlie was the guy who was supposed to be brainwashing me so I could learn how to do it. But the brainwashing really didn't take hold till I got down there and saw what was going on. But Charlie used to lock me in his attic with the turntable. Not exactly, but kind of like that. I stayed with him for a couple weeks one time, and that's all we did was he'd play records for me and tell me about them. And the band, the Hall Brothers, probably didn't sound very good at that point. I don't know if it ever did, but it was reasonably good. And we actually, on that first trip in 62, everybody got down there for at least part of the time, and we played at a private party that was at Preservation Hall. The guy who ran the place, Alan Jaffe, was continually trying to put together things like that, and he'd invite some of the musicians to come and see what was going on, and that's who the other guests were. But we didn't have any, I sure didn't have any idea what were they thinking, because we're trying to copy what they play, and they were very polite. And in fact, actually, some of them got pretty enthused, and then they wanted to play with us. So it was a really great experience. But I just can't imagine. These guys were extremely nice people. They would invite you into their homes after they'd known you for 5 minutes, and give you this great food, and you were their friend if they thought you were seriously interested in the music. Once they saw that, they'd do anything for you. So they were extraordinary that way, and very indulgent, I think, of upstarts in general. But so we got to play for them, and boy, I didn't know anything about their music, so I can't imagine what this was like. I was playing clarinet. So yeah, I was trying to do it. Anybody else? Or do you want to go eat lunch? That's probably better. We're going to be late. Anyway, thanks very much. You're very patient. I appreciate that.